From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. That's been the sound of America in recent weeks. Angry crowds of furious teachers, nurses, and firefighters. Not the kind of people you imagine storming a state capitol. But then these are unusual circumstances.
The state of New York spends too much money. It is that blunt and it is that simple.
The facts are clear. Wisconsin is broke.
New Jersey is in a financial state of crisis.
California faces a crisis that is real and unprecedented.
Here in Alabama, we have inherited a budget that at best is unrealistic. We do not have enough money.
From north to south and east to west, state governors are telling voters they've got no choice but to close schools, shut down public programs, and slash wages and benefits for public employees. In the nation's capital, Democrats and Republicans are downsizing the federal budget. But austerity is a choice. Maybe it's a good one. Maybe it's not. In this hour, we'll talk about it.
I agree the problem is debt. The question is, how do you pay it back? What are the mechanisms, what are the methods, and who pays for it?
That's Mark Blythe, a political economist at Brown University and author of a forthcoming book called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. As you can tell from his accent, he hails from Great Britain, Scotland, actually, where they know something about national debt. Blythe says when he looks at all the countries around the world currently enacting austerity measures,
I see something which is superficially appealing, individually rational perhaps, and ultimately collectively disastrous. I don't deny the problem is debt over the past 20 or 30 years, both on our personal balance sheets as consumers and on our corporate balance sheets and on our state, national and local balance sheets. We've loaded up a lot of debt and we need to do something with it. But there's a problem. While it's individually rational for any, let's say, household to tighten its belt because their income stream's gone down, but if everyone does this at the same time, all that happens is you shrink the economy. And what's fascinating and disturbing at the moment is how this fallacious thought has grabbed the attention of the governing classes on a global level, on a state level, a national level, and on a local level. We cannot simultaneously all cut our way to prosperity. Someone needs to consume when someone is not consuming. Someone needs to export when someone is importing. We cannot all export at once. In Europe just now, we find this conversation based around austerity. We need to become more like the Germans. Well, we can't all be like the Germans because someone has to buy the BMWs.
But what about in a country like the United States? The economic recession hit everybody. I live in Wisconsin, which has a debt that everybody is talking about now. There are those who say it is a smaller debt than Illinois, for instance, or California's. Are you saying that each of us needs to take a different approach to debt?
The way I like to put it is this. I'm absolutely in favor of us all tightening our belts the minute we're all wearing the same pants. And we are not wearing the same pants. Whether it's across the income distribution, whether it's across the assets that we hold, we have very, very different balance sheet positions. If you're a single mom, if you're dependent upon working two jobs on minimum wage, your position in this recession is vastly different from someone who has $250,000 in assets and a mortgage which was paid off 5 years ago. So we're not all in the same position going into this.
What you're really talking about is something that we in the United States don't like to talk about very much, and that's class politics, isn't it?
You can use the phrase class politics, and in fact, I have done so. As you're probably guessing from my accent, I come from a country whereby you can say that and it's not considered a weird thing. But what we are talking about is a differential across the income distribution where those who basically made out the best in the past 10, 15 years of the financial boom are the ones who are not bearing the costs of the financial bust. So ordinary people at the bottom end of the income distribution, you can call them middle class, you can call them working class, whatever you want, are the ones whose incomes are relatively fixed, have not had great wage rises, if any real wage rises, when you take inflation into account over the past decade and a half or longer, are the ones who are stressed out in debt, are the ones whose jobs are much more fragile these days. And they're the ones who, first of all, have to pay for the bailouts in terms of the increase in government debt, which means at the local and national level, more interest payments, which means higher taxes or lesser spending. So they're doubly taxed, first of all, by paying for the bailouts, and secondly, by the lost growth. And then thirdly, by the consolidation that meant to come along afterwards to clean up the mess. Meanwhile, at the top of the income distribution, Jamie Dimon from Barclays has just got $6.8 million as a new bonus. Well, you know, things are nice at the top.
So I guess that doesn't help us come back to what the government should do about this. We can all complain about the people who have getting more and the people who don't have getting less. But what does that mean in terms of practical politics? What can you do on a government basis to try to raise everybody's boat?
There has to be some hard and consistent choices made from top to bottom. We are spending too much money relative to our tax take. If you're basically bringing in 19% of GDP in taxes and spending 30, you've got a problem. Somehow you're going to have to figure out a way to pay more taxes. Now, either that means top earners pay more, or it means you have a national value-added tax, or something else. And if you don't want to pay taxes, then simply give up trying to do certain things, like, for example, the fire department. Because things cost money. Roads cost money. Education costs money. The single most expensive discretionary item in the federal budget is Medicare D, prescription drugs for elderly people. If you're really serious about getting control of the budget, that needs to be cut. You can cut every single discretionary program apart from that one. You won't make a difference. So hard choices need to be made on taxes and spending. And simply skirting around the margins and pretending that by beating up on unions you'll produce 250,000 jobs is really just ridiculous.
You've looked at this on an international basis, and clearly the standard now is to go for an austerity budget. We're not seeing much of anybody who is pursuing stimulus spending, for instance. How can it be so clear to you and so completely unclear to the people in power?
It's a really interesting question. There are very strong electoral incentives for any Democratic politician to cut taxes. There are no incentives to raise them. You're out of a job. Nothing succeeds like success. We had 30 years of privatization, deregulation, treating your house as an ATM, credit cards and the whole thing. And while there's a moral story that says people were living beyond their means, they were living beyond their means because they had no other means, because their wages were not growing relative to the costs of sending your kids to college and paying for your healthcare expenditures. So what we need to do is to rethink entirely, I think, from the ground up, what it is that we're trying to do with government and what it is we're trying to shelter and from what we're trying to shelter and where and why.
Is there enough money to pay for all of these things? Is it possible to balance cuts and taxes enough to stabilize the economy?
It's not a technical question. It's always a political question. I have a friend and colleague who occasionally teaches in Sweden. And he does a little experiment, which I do as well, which we stand in front of our students, maybe 100, 200 students, and we start off and we say, how many of you think that paying 90% taxes is crazy? And in Sweden, everyone thinks that's crazy. But once you get down to 70%, they begin to think it's reasonable. And basically, they settle around 60 or 50%. Why? Because they get a free, high-quality higher education, because healthcare is paid for by the state, because public transport isn't awful and called Amtrak, etc., etc. So if you have high-quality public goods, you're willing to pay for them because you get what you pay for. In the United States, I do the same thing. I start at the other end of the distribution and say, is 10% okay? And usually people settle on 20 to 30%, but aren't willing to go any higher than that. Why? Because they have an experience that a lot of them go to private school because the state-supplied school wasn't good enough. They invest and they save their money and they don't expect the state to do for them. And you end up with bad quality public goods, which are residualized and treated as welfare goods for people who can't afford private alternatives. In that society, raising taxes is very dangerous because everyone will say, why would you want to give it to the state? The state's awful. So the politics here are what matter. It's not a question of an accounting gimmick. Is there enough money? Absolutely. The United States currently spends, I believe the figure is, 46% of all defense expenditures on the planet. That's a huge amount of money.
I'm stunned by that. I guess I want you to repeat that. 46%?
46. Either 46 or 43% of total defense expenditures worldwide. Now, you have to remember the United States is 20% of the global economy. So to pay for 46% of defense expenditures only takes up 5% of GDP. It's good to be big. But think what you could do with 1% of that GDP if you weren't spending it there and you were spending it on someone else. But then it becomes a question of, well, why should we spend it on something else? Because the United States, in part, is founded on a belief that people provide for themselves. That's efficient. Markets are good. The state is the last resort.
All right. Comes down to the last question, then. Austerity is the push right now, nationwide here, and in fact, worldwide. If growth is not going to be the result from the current policies, what do you think is going to happen?
Essentially, a very long-term stagnation. You see this already in the way that we've accepted rather passively that unemployment in the United States is going to remain around 10, 9, or 8% into the foreseeable future. The great American jobs machine has ground to a halt, and it's going to start again, but not at the same rate. Where we see job growth being concentrated is in the low-wage sector and the most flexible part of the labor market. So you're going to see greater income skewing over time. So what we get is a polarization of income and consequent polarization of politics. And if you have a party in charge that blames everything and anything on unions, even though they're less than 10% of all workers, and changing collective bargaining is somehow going to balance the budget, then we're into a very destructive cycle of blaming and a politics of blame attribution that really has no good end. And it's something that, frankly, I'm very worried about. I agree the problem is debt. The question is, how do you pay it back? What are the mechanisms? What are the methods? And who pays for it? How do you apportion not just blame but responsibility for fiscal sanity rather than simply freaking out about debt numbers that make no sense in isolation and turning around and saying that everything the state does is always and everywhere bad? Because when you're doing that, you're talking about the fireman, the teacher, and the Medicaid prescription benefit that you rely upon.
Mark Blythe is a professor of international political economy at Brown University. He's a member of the Warwick Commission on International Financial Reform, and he's working on a new book called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. You can watch his short video about austerity on our website at ttbook.org. Now, I need to pause for a moment of full disclosure here. When Mark Blythe talked about nurses and teachers, he could also have mentioned some public radio producers, like us. Wisconsin Public Radio, which produces to the best of our knowledge, is licensed to the University of Wisconsin, which makes those of us who work on this show public employees. Wisconsin is also ground zero in the national debate about the benefits and rights of public employees. For weeks, hundreds of thousands of protesters have marched in and around the state capitol in Wisconsin, just a few blocks from our studios. The city rings with their voices.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. The union makes us strong.
It's not just Madison, Wisconsin, that's seeing protests from public employees. Ohio, Michigan, New Jersey, lots of other states are also cutting wages and benefits for teachers and nurses and other public workers. Why are so many governors, especially Republican governors, balancing their state budgets by making public sector employees pay more? Steve Paulson put that question to Stephen Malanga, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the author of Shakedown, the continuing conspiracy against the American taxpayer.
Well, first of all, I think it's inevitable that public sector workers in some places, in many places perhaps, are going to have to pay more, because when you look at the size of those promises we've made that government hasn't funded for public employees, they're staggering. In a place like Illinois, if they took all the money that they collected in taxes every year for the next 6 years and put it in their pension funds, they would finally catch up. That's how far behind they are.
So one of the big problems you're saying is just how do you pay for the pension benefits?
Many places have also made promises to pay for health care benefits for people in retirement. What you have in a lot of places, I read somewhere, for instance, that New Jersey has as many retirees as they have state workers actually working right now, which means they're essentially paying health care benefits for two workforces. So that's a problem. There's no question that the day of reckoning is kind of here. We now have actuarial reports stating, for instance, that some of New Jersey's pension funds, government pension funds, could begin running out of money as quickly as 4 or 5 years from now, which is kind of staggering because that's not just being underfunded. That's completely having no money left and having to take money out of your yearly budget in order to pay your retirees, which is unsustainable.
Are you saying that public sector employees are paid too much?
Every state is different and every municipality is different. Are they overcompensated in Mississippi? Almost certainly no. Are they overcompensated in Texas? We could go through a whole bunch of places. So it's very difficult to make national assumptions like that. And so you have to sort of really get into the numbers. When you do, I would say yes, that the benefits that are offered in the public sector in many states, but certainly not in every state, the benefits are out of proportion to what you see in the private sector. And the way they're structured, we've got early retirement and people living longer. So you got two things going in the opposite direction. They've become unsustainable, and they are out of proportion.
Let me follow up on that, though, because there are obviously conflicting studies that come to different conclusions. And there's a study that just came out from Jeffrey Keefe, a labor and management professor at Rutgers, who says, actually, this is not true. And his analysis shows that if you compare private and public employees with the same amount of educational background, same experience and work schedule, private employees make 11% more in wages and 5% more in total compensation than public workers. And total compensation for workers in the private sector with bachelor's degrees is $89,000 compared to $57,000 for public workers.
There are a lot of things I can say about that study. But one of the things they tend to do is they tend to look at all the jobs, put them all together. Okay, when you start disaggregating, here's what you find over and over again. Higher educated public sector workers don't make as much as workers in the private sector. In one study, I saw they were quoting psychiatrists who work for public institutions don't make as much as psychiatrists in the private sector. Well, that's not a surprise to most people. But at the place where you find most public sector employment, especially at the municipal level, public safety, fire, also sanitation, transit workers. Even these studies showed that there's a big difference. Now we're just talking about wages. The other part of this is compensation, total compensation, including benefits. And one of the reasons that we're in the kind of trouble that we're in right now is that politicians, sometimes I would say abetted by some of these public pension associations, have used accounting methods that have consistently underestimated the true cost of those benefits.
Let's step back for a moment and talk about how one can deal with this problem, because I think just about everyone says the deficit is a problem. I mean, people across the political spectrum, and it seems to me there are basically two ways to deal with it. You can either cut government spending or you can increase taxes. So I have to ask, why not target upper income earners with higher taxes?
Well, if you look at the states that have had the most persistent budget problems over the last decade, and this is even before 2008 and 2009, if you look at those states and the states with the highest public sector compensation costs, look at which states those are: New York, New Jersey, Illinois, California, Rhode Island. These states, except for Illinois, which is a special case we can talk about, these states already have among the highest taxes in the country. New Jersey in 2004 was going to solve its budget problems with the so-called millionaire's tax. It enacted a millionaire's tax, which actually started at $500,000 a year, so it's kind of a half millionaire's tax, but it was called the millionaire's tax. That didn't work. 2 years later, the new governor, Governor Corzine, said, well, we need another solution. So he did a sales tax increase, which hit everybody. That didn't work. They still had this enormous budget problem. Then he turned around and they did a whole bunch of taxes last year. They taxed rich people, but they also took away the property tax deduction. They took away the property tax rebates for middle-class people. In the end, it winds up trickling down. The thing that they never did in New Jersey was control costs, was control expenditures. So you see a series of tax increases on a whole range of people having essentially no effect, and Jersey is just now a fiscal wreck.
But I don't understand this. Why can't you tax people? Let's go back to the million
because there's
dollar
something,
club.
Yes, because
clearly, if you tax them at higher rates, it should bring in more money, right? Why doesn't that work?
Because there's something that economists call basically tax capacity. If you have higher and higher and higher rates, you get less and less from it, particularly, remember, we're talking about a recession. We're talking about when people's incomes are falling as it is. And so let me give you an example, okay? Andrew Cuomo gave this example, the new governor of New York State, in his budget address, and he ran as a Democrat on an agenda of no new taxes. Why? He said, let me point something out to you. During all this period of time, we have been increasing the New York State budget, including money we have to spend on pensions and healthcare, at an annual rate of 5%, 5.4% compounded. He said, during that entire time, our government has been growing faster than the wealth of its people. There is no way to tax yourself out of that in the long run.
So you're saying that essentially the only thing you can do is cut government spending, and the big way to do that is to make public sector workers pay more, particularly for their pensions and health insurance.
Well, again, we're making national generalizations. Underneath it all, there's a lot of stuff going on. In fact, the National Governors Association recently put out a report in which they said, look, this is not the old cycle of deficit and then expansion, deficit and then expansion. They use the term a new fiscal reality, which is going to require states to start asking fundamental questions again. What kind of government do we want? What kind of services do we want to pay for? What are our priorities?
One final question, and I say this as someone who has been watching the political battle unfold just a mile from where I work in downtown Madison, Wisconsin. I mean, I've never seen Wisconsin so divided politically, and it worries me. Does it worry you to see these kinds of battles, political battles, play out and what the consequences are for people trying to live together and work together?
Well, you know, I'm a little bit older than you are, and I was a kid during the 60s and the 70s. And what I see today is nothing compared to what I saw when people were in the streets back then, when you had the hard hats marching on Washington on one side of the avenue and the students for Democratic Society. And so, no, actually, it doesn't worry me. I've seen quite a lot. And I don't think this is anything comparable to the upheavals of, let's say, May 66, of the early 70s. So, no, it doesn't worry me.
Stephen Malanga is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the author of Shakedown, The Continuing Conspiracy Against the American Taxpayer.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall, for he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside is raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times, they are a-changing.
Next, even with a giant deficit staring us in the face, America is still one of the richest nations in the world. And maybe this is a silly question, but where did all the money go? Stay with us. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That's not supposed to be the American way, and it didn't used to be. In the 1950s and 60s, American income was distributed pretty evenly. Well, sure, there were poor people and rich people, but the gap between them wasn't all that big. In the 1970s, that gap began to grow. And grow. Until today, the majority of America's income is concentrated at the very top. How did that happen?
Committee will please come to order. Dr. Greenspan, I want to start with you. And my question for you is simple. Were you wrong? Be sure the mic is turned on.
We're talking about explaining major world historic events.
If the banks are more willing to lend, it becomes easier to spend.
It's been an enormous pyramiding of income and wealth in the last 30 years.
The median wage is stagnated.
The closer you are to the money, the more of it you make.
If I took anybody and I paid them $10 million for the job.
Here we go.
If I took you and I started paying you $10 million for your job, in 2 weeks you will think you'll deserve it.
I'm looking forward to my next billion.
Scenes from a new documentary about the origins of today's budget crisis. It's called The Flaw. It premiered at Sundance recently. One of the people behind the movie is economic historian Lewis Hyman, author of a new book called Debtor Nation. He told Anne Strange Champs that the structural problem that's causing America's budget crisis is income inequality.
It's gone through the roof in the last 40 years. Basically, all the gains in the economy in the last 40 years have gone to the top 1%. And in that top 1%, mostly to the top 0.1%. And within that, the top 0.01%.
Who are those people?
Who are those people? They're people who make millions of dollars a year. Those people are largely hidden from view. We don't see them. Or if we see them, we don't know who they are.
Now, in pure economic terms, why does it matter where the wealth goes? Because
sure.
Just in terms of the functioning of the economy, you would think, doesn't really matter. As long as that top 2% spend all their money and it trickles down to the rest of us, then the economy will keep growing and functioning, right?
Well, here's the thing. The very wealthy can't spend their money the way you and I spend our money. If I get another $10, I'm probably going to buy a pizza. If a rich person gets another $10, they're going to put it in the bank or they're going to buy a very expensive asset with it. They're going to buy houses. They're going to buy yachts. And we see this kind of incredible inflation at the top for housing prices. That's where so much of this money went in the years before the crisis. At the same time, they also put it into savings. They're responsible. They give their money to their investors. They invest in a hedge fund or private equity or just Vanguard. And that money has to be put somewhere. That money has to be invested. For everyday people, we see the world as a nearly unlimited amount of investment. We can buy as much stock in Apple as we want. We can buy as much stock in Microsoft as we want. But when you look at the market caps of these kinds of companies, they're actually smaller in value than these huge pools of capital, not just from the American wealthy, but the global wealthy, the sovereign wealth funds and things like that. And they've run out of places to put their money safely, right? So this is the appeal of these mortgage-backed securities. They get a slightly better return than a treasury bond, but with the same level of safety, it was thought. So that's what sort of drove all this, that all this money could be put into these investments, and which in turn financed the borrowing that you and I did because we didn't have a dollar.
Well, I'm getting a picture of something that I know has to be wrong. I'm getting a picture of this gigantic hidden pot of money that's somewhere away from everybody else. And meanwhile, everybody else, the 90% of the rest of us, are squabbling over the tiny little scrapings that are left, which makes me think, where's the pot of money?
The pot of money is invested by Goldman Sachs, and the pot of money is invested by these sort of large financial industries. That's why the finance industry has grown to such a disproportionate share of our economy in the last 20 years. Finance used to be the handmaiden of manufacturing. All the smart people in the 1950s who got MBAs at Harvard went into production. They went into manufacturing. They worked at Bethlehem Steel because steel is what beat the Nazis. It wasn't accounting that beat the Nazis. And something changed in America. The big money could start to be made in finance and not in manufacturing. The big money was made in being clever about moving money around rather than inventing new science. This is part of what caused the Great Depression. During the Great Depression, there was a huge amount of capital that was pulled out of our capital markets because people were nervous to invest it. And one of the things that got us out of the Great Depression was World War II in the sense of inventing the aerospace industry. Mm. World War II in the sense of inventing the electronics industry. Places where vast amounts of capital could be invested profitably. And basically, that's what's happening now. We are desperate for a place to put all this money that can create jobs. But it's very difficult to invest in China. It's very difficult to find the next green technology that we should actually put our money in that would make money back for us. So once we find that new place to invest our money, I think this whole situation can be turned around.
That's so interesting because there's been a lot of blame assigned to the bad lenders who created all those horrible subprime mortgages that made a lot of ordinary Americans lose their shirts. It sounds like you're saying it wasn't necessarily individual greed. It was a system that got set up that then perpetuated itself.
Well, I think it's naive to think that people aren't greedy and haven't always been greedy. That's how capitalism works. I'm not interested in assigning blame to a couple people. Obviously, there were people who tricked people, and that's bad. But I don't know. It just, to me, it seems to miss the larger point that it's people acting within the rules of capitalism that we set and we can control. And until we change those rules, nothing's going to change. Until we change the fact that this was driven by inequality and wage stagnation, we tried to substitute credit for wages. Until we address those problems, these things will occur again and again and again.
Right now, there's widespread agreement on both sides of the political aisle that the big problem facing the economy is the deficit. Sounds like you're saying that fixing that deficit is not going to be enough.
I think that it's not a question of adjusting a few macroeconomic indicators. It's about being smart about where this money goes. It's not just enough for the government to spend. It has to spend wisely, or not at all. It just has to create the structure so that private capital can be invested profitably. When you look at, for instance, Germany. Germany has an incredible export-led economy. One of the reasons it has this, for instance, in green energy, which everyone's so excited about, it's because they created a fixed price for individuals to produce solar energy and sell it back to the grid. This allowed people to invest. It allowed people to borrow. It allowed pig farmers to create solar panels on their farms, and it allowed an entire new industry to be developed. Business wants structure. They want to know the rules of the game and then how to play in them. It's not about just fixing the deficit. Fixing the deficit won't change anything if suddenly there's no more incentives for science. Looking at our budget right now, less than 0.5% of our federal budget goes to science research. This is complete madness to me, because science is what drives technological change, which is what drives economic growth. And as long as we have 0.5% of our budget funding all of our scientific research, we're never going to get ahead.
So if we were to enact the sorts of policies you have in mind, what would they be?
I think we would try to figure out a way to enable the investment in green technology, similar to the way we enacted policies to invest in aerospace. I'm not an industrialist. I'm a historian. I'm sure there are lots of scientists and industrial engineers who are clamoring for funds to build their businesses up. To get the economy going again, we need to create environments where risks can be taken. One of the great tragedies of the healthcare reform of the past few years was that we didn't create a public option, which would have allowed all these risky young entrepreneurs to go out there and build businesses. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, and this is, I was curious to see this not in much of the debate, why do we make our car companies pay for our healthcare? Japanese car companies don't have to pay for their healthcare. German car companies don't have to pay for the healthcare of their workers. They let them make cars, and then the state takes care of that because it enables a situation where risk can be taken, where economies can grow and corporations can focus on what they do best. And of course, the most important thing would be a way to figure out how to securitize business loans. Securitization now has a bad odor to it after everything with the mortgages and
sort of think there is no such thing as securitization anymore.
But securitization, just as things were about to fall apart, they started to try and figure out how to securitize business loans. And what this would do would make it very easy to invest in businesses the way it was all too easy to invest in houses. Houses produce no value. They're not a farm. We've truncated the homestead to a home, right? A farm in the 19th century created value. It created economic products. Homes don't do anything like that. They're non-productive assets. What we need to do is figure out ways to make it easy to invest in productive assets like businesses.
Are there countries you can point to that have done this and have arrived at the same brink that we are, you know, where you had governor after governor saying, you know, we're broke, and you were looking at really widespread pain and economic trauma spread throughout an entire citizenry? Are there other countries that have been in this place and pulled themselves back?
I can think of one country in particular that did it. It's called America. We did it before. We did it before in the Great Depression, and we can do it again today. We just need to look back to history to see the kinds of policies that worked. History doesn't repeat itself, but there are certainly lots of analogies between the 30s and today in terms of we're on the brink of technological change, and we just have to find the public will to muster it.
Lewis Hyman, talking with Anne Strainchamps. Hyman is an economic historian at Harvard and the author of Debtor Nation. He's also featured in a new documentary film about the causes of the financial collapse. It's called The Flaw. You can see the trailer on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In cities and states across the country, austerity budgets are bad news for teachers. California sent layoff notices to 19,000 teachers. Detroit plans to close half of its public schools or convert them to charters. Wisconsin stripped collective bargaining rights from its teachers. Education expert Diane Ravitch says what's happening to public schools in America is not about the money. Ravitch herself is part of the story. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under George Bush Sr. She was a strong proponent of charter schools and the No Child Left Behind program. But in a new book called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch says she's changed her mind. She told Steve Paulson there's a political agenda behind all the recent school cuts.
This is not just states responding to the need for austerity. The larger picture and the context which I've been trying to provide both in my book and in my lectures has been we have a very powerful corporate reform movement. They talk about reform. What their real goals are is, first of all, privatization, taking public money out of the public sector and having deregulated schools with very little public oversight. So it's privatization, but it's also deprofessionalization. They want to be able to hire teachers who have very little training, and also to hire principals who were never educators and to hire superintendents who were never educators and to relax the rules across the board. The thing that's so wrong about all of this is, first of all, there is absolutely no research to support any of these changes, that they don't improve things for kids. And secondly, if you look at the highest performing nations in the world, none of them are doing this. They are strengthening and improving their public education sector.
What would be an example of that, of another country,
sure,
a success story where there's a different model?
The great success story is Finland. And Finland really changed its education system over the past 30 years to recruit and attract the best teachers. Finland is first in the world on the international assessment called PISA, Program and International Student Assessment. And on the PISA, Finland is first in the world. It's 100% union, and it never gives any standardized tests at all until kids apply to college. 40% of the kids in its high schools are in training for career programs, but they all take the same tests that our kids do. And it has a very low rate of poverty. I mean, this is the big, big difference between the U.S. and Finland, and that is that less than 3% of their children are in poverty, and more than 20% of our children are in poverty. The great narrative in this country that's coming from people like, whether it's the right wing of the Republican Party or President Obama and the Gates Foundation, it's all the same narrative, and that is that poverty doesn't matter. And yet we have decades and decades of social science that says that poverty is the single most powerful predictor of low academic achievement. And so when you have a city like Detroit or Baltimore or any number of others that I could mention that have very low rates of academic achievement, it correlates with very, very high rates of not only poverty, but racial isolation.
Let's talk more about charter schools, because this is being held up now as the great alternative to our decades of public schools. First of all, tell us a little bit about how charter schools are set up. I mean, for the most part, these are within the public school structure, but they have private management, right?
Charter schools have become the replacement for vouchers. And whenever vouchers have been put to a vote, they have been turned down. So charters have become the stand-in because they are privately managed. They get public money. They are not subject to the same rules and regulations as public schools. In most states, they're not even subject to regulations having to do with nepotism and conflict of interest.
So you're saying there are no standards in terms of who can teach in a charter school?
No, none. They can hire anybody. And about 98% of charter schools are non-union. They can hire and fire at will. They can give merit pay or performance pay or whatever they want to call it. And they don't get better results than regular public schools. The media likes to focus on the one charter school where 100% of the kids went on to college. But what they never bothered to look at is how many kids started. And so I've seen story after story of a charter school held up as a miracle school where 150 kids started, but only, let's say, 100 of them graduated. In some cases, it's even smaller than that. Our charter schools where they're getting great test scores, but they hold back the kids from the testing who are not going to get great test scores, where they just play with the stats.
So, how can they hold back certain kids so
they don't take
the tests?
They're not required to promote everybody. So the kids who can't get the great scores are held back and not put into the year where the test will be given. This has happened in place after place. The biggest way in which they are able to game the system is by taking smaller proportions of students who are English language learners, and this has happened in many places, are not taking the kids with profound disabilities.
So you're saying charter schools can reject certain students in a way that the public schools cannot?
They have ways to do that. The lottery is a way of screening out, for instance, homeless families who never find out that there is a lottery. Then there are other kinds of mechanisms that they use to counsel students out. I've been contacted by principals and others who said, every November 1st, I get a wave of the lowest performing kids from the local charter school because they don't want them to drag down their scores. So they send them to my school, dragging down my scores. So this is what competition has created, is everyone's competing to get rid of the low performing kids. This is not good education. This is just the free market distorting what education is supposed to be, which is to attend to the needs of every child and make sure that every child gets a full, balanced education. We're now into a kind of national test score mania that's really corrupting education.
Now, it's also worth pointing out that President Obama is a big fan of charter schools.
Right. President Obama, and I can't explain why this is so, has completely adopted the Republican agenda. The Republican agenda in education for the last 30 years, at least since Ronald Reagan, has been testing, accountability, and choice. Particularly, President Reagan supported vouchers, but then it morphed into this idea of charters taking the place of vouchers. President Obama has sent out Secretary Duncan to campaign with Newt Gingrich in the fall of 2009. President Obama just the other day was in Miami with ex-Governor Jeb Bush, who is reviled by teachers because of his support for vouchers, for charters, for testing, for judging teachers by test scores. He has taken a very strong privatization line, and President Obama was in Miami to salute him as an education reformer and to celebrate test scores at a high school in Miami.
Now, I have to ask you about your own perspective on all of these things, because you were once a huge advocate of No Child Left Behind. You were a big advocate of charter schools, and it's worth pointing out your track record is not exactly as a flaming liberal on education issues. You were the Assistant Secretary of Education under the first President Bush. Later, you received funding from various conservative groups, the John M. Olin Foundation, the Hoover Institution. What happened?
Well, I changed my mind over time. Like, for instance, in 2004, I publicly wrote an op-ed piece with Randy Weingarten saying that mayoral control in New York City was leaving the public out of public education. So that was a beginning. There were other moments where I was in meetings with governors and CEOs who were complaining about those overpaid teachers. And I looked around the table and thought, there's not a person in this room who could live on a teacher's salary. That changed my mind. But the moment that I concluded that NCLB was a failure was
No Child Left Behind.
No Child Left Behind. When I concluded that the federal law itself was a failure was when I was invited to a meeting, a day-long meeting at a conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. And my job was to sum up the papers that day. The conference was about how's No Child Left Behind doing? What progress have we made in the first half decade? And there were a dozen papers, and each of the papers said it's not working. choice is not working. The required tutoring is not working. We're not seeing any real improvement in test scores. And there were papers from across the country. There were papers from rural areas. There were papers from big cities. There were papers from the East, the West, the North, the South. And at the end of the day, I had to sum this up, and I had to say, it's not working. And from that moment on, I really found my own views about No Child Left Behind dramatically altered.
Now, you've talked about what you see as wrong with a lot of educational policy now, especially the efforts to reform schools. What should we be thinking about? I mean, what makes the best schools?
Well, the first thing that makes the best schools is having a community of deeply involved families and parents, and having children who are well-fed, who don't have medical problems, having children arrive in school ready to learn, and having a balanced curriculum that includes all the things that we know matter, not just basic skills of reading, writing, and math, but also history and geography and civics and the arts, having a great arts program, physical education, a health program. All of those things are important in a good school. But within the context of a community where there are immense social problems, the government has to address the social problems. We can't assume that schools alone can solve the problems of poverty. We lead the world now, at least amongst the advanced nations, in the number of children living in poverty. And that hurts educational achievement. There are people, and I've heard Secretary Duncan say this, I've heard various educational leaders, most of them non-educators, say poverty doesn't matter. Poverty does matter. When children are hungry, when children are sick, when children are homeless, when they live in a community where crime and violence and incarceration and unemployment and decay, when these things are commonplace, it affects their motivation, it affects their attitude, it affects even their willingness to come to school every day. So what most educators have long understood is there is an interconnection between school and society. John Dewey wrote about this. Other wise people have written about this. Schools don't stand alone. They're part of a community. They should be the element that uplifts the community, that civilizes the community, that brings a sense of what the better things in life are, that gives children a sense of possibility, of ambition, of breaking the limits. But they can't do that in isolation. They do it only when working in tandem with a government that is humane, compassionate, and concerned about the well-being of its citizens.
Diane Ravitch was Assistant Secretary of Education under George Bush Sr. She's written more than 20 books about education, most recently, The Death and Life of the Great American School System. For another take on schools, we go next to David Brooks, one of the most prominent newspaper columnists in America. He writes regularly for the New York Times, and he's a frequent commentator on public radio and public television. Brooks has a particular interest in education reform, which he's been following for decades. Unlike Diane Ravitch, he says the old way of education needs to change.
Well, I do think we need to cut somewhere in spending. We have an unsustainable situation, but the question is how we cut. My general thesis is that we need to cut a lot of spending on affluent elderly people, especially in healthcare, and spend more as much on education. But if we're going to cut education, Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, has a good idea, which is we're probably going to have to increase some class sizes. That's survivable so long as we direct our students to the best teachers. It's better to be in a big class with a great teacher than a small class with a mediocre teacher. And if we're going to ask our best teachers to work with bigger classroom sizes, we should be willing to pay them more for taking on the extra challenges. And that's one way you can cut by increasing class sizes, but do it in a way that won't harm educational outcomes.
Do you see part of the problem here as teachers' unions? I mean, do you think they're protecting the bad teachers?
More so, I think there's a factory mentality that some people have, which is that every teacher should be treated the same and that the only way to measure is by the number of years. I think younger teachers are much less prone to have this mentality. They're used to a world in which they're measured on merit. I think we have to differentiate more on merit and then reward more on merit and then take the people who aren't doing as well and work hard to improve them.
You're saying for the most part, this is not happening now.
Well, it's happening more than ever before. for 20 or 30 years, we more or less just moved bureaucratic boxes. We tried big schools, small schools, all that kind of stuff, and it really didn't have much of an effect. Now we're really focusing on the crucial issue, which is the relationship between the teacher and the student.
Now, there are some states that are basically beginning to give up on public schools and move aggressively toward charter schools instead. And, but a few of the early supporters of charter schools, most prominently Diane Ravitch, are now saying they don't work and that privatizing school is a terrible idea.
My reading of the evidence is that the charters overall have had some gains, but modest. But that's because some charters are really good and some are bad. I still think there's potential for charters because their flexibility allows them to be learning organizations. I'm sort of hopeful about some of the charters that have tried new things. They have different ethoses, and I think they have the greater ability to evolve simply because they're more flexible.
Well, one of the questions is whether we need to think about school, about the educational system in a different way. And it would seem that one of the models behind a lot of the charter schools is to treat education more as a business. I mean, this is all part of the privatizing model, and to sort of step away from the teaching establishment, maybe not require teachers to get the usual teacher certification. I guess the question is whether the business model works in an educational setting.
Well, I'm not sure about the for-profit, but sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. The teacher evaluation model, I think, works. When you measure results and you ask people to live up to certain result standards, I think that essentially works. If you look at the teacher certification, I think if you look at the average Teacher America teacher versus the average teacher who's gone through the certification process, I think they're roughly equal at least. I'm not a huge fan of the certification rules. I think it's important to have training to know how to manage a classroom. But outstanding teachers have skills and personalities that are really hard to measure and replicate, and I'm not sure they can be taught at a teacher certification program. And so I would open up education to a wider variety of people, even people who don't want to get masters in education, because some people have the skills and they just don't want to go through the process.
Well, I know one of the mantras these days is we need to do more with less, and you know that certainly applies to schools as well. But do you worry that this really just means doing less?
It doesn't have to be. Obviously, spending on education has increased by, I don't know, probably three times over the last generation or two, and the educational results are much worse than they were a generation or two. The relationship between money and education is a very loose relationship. Again, it all comes back to the teacher. If the teacher's good, then they will produce good students. You don't need to surround them with fancy whiteboards and computers and some of the great facilities that now exist in schools. And so we should be spending money, but we should be spending on what matters, on teacher quality.
David Brooks writes frequently for The New York Times and is a regular commentator on public radio and television. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can listen to this hour online or find a link to the podcast on our website at ttbook.org. If you want a CD copy, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Question Austerity Program, number 320A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Ann Strainchance, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.